Coming today on Breaking Free, a modern divorce podcast.
Unfortunately, with experience, I've learned the second they say simple, it is a difficult case.
Yeah. Never believe the attorneys.
Welcome to Breaking Free, a modern divorce podcast with Rebecca Zung and Susan Guthrie.
This is the place to hear other people's stories, to learn from the top experts in every related field, to also have some fun, laugh, and hang with two divorce attorney girlfriends who are also top family law litigators.
And now we invite you to listen to today's show.
It's going to inspire you to transform and break free. This is part two of a two-part episode where we talk with Dr. Christina Hansen, a highly respected and experienced child custody evaluator who gives the real lowdown on exactly when evaluators are appointed, in what types of cases, how they do the evaluations, and what they are looking for. Let's dive in.
Yeah, I mean, so you really have that ability to, as you unfold the story and the facts, you have that ability to go to other witnesses to either bolster those facts or debunk the, you know, what one parent says. So I think one of the things for our listeners maybe to understand is that a custody evaluation is not a 1 week and done type of process. What is your average? I just think it would be helpful to people because this is one of the things I have to tell my clients up front when we're going in for, they're going in for an eval is, you know, expect this. In Connecticut, where I practiced, it could take up to 6 months to get your evaluation done. I know that's long, but what's your experience?
You know, I've had one case that finished it within 60 days. And they were both extremely efficient, anxious people. So that helped. And so, I mean, from their first interviews, they had all the documents I requested from them to me within 3 days. The only case I've ever seen that happen. I have had it go on for up to 2 years. And I've had ones where I've thought, it's not even going to start. I literally am going to email the attorneys and say, please remove me from this court order because we're getting nowhere. And then we finish it. So it depends. And I've had ones that we've been requesting documents overseas. You know, we're requesting documents in Italy, in, you know, England, London. You know, we had a request records in India, in Dubai. So, I mean, that can take a while for the attorney to be able to subpoena those records on my behalf, you know, to go through the translation, work with the courts over there to be able to get the records or the professionals, things like that. So it could take time for that kind of information. Or if a parent is living internationally, maybe they're not living in the US, and for them to be able to get their ducks in a row, to be able to travel here, get visas, things like that, be able to work with their employers to get over here, stuff like that. So that can take time and it can slow down the evaluation. Absolutely.
Yeah, I've always found that even the ones that seem simplest, if the parties are very reluctant to participate, everything takes forever because everything is compelled. So it can just take a long time if the parties themselves are being dragged into the evaluation process themselves. I have always, you know, when you get those cases that are high conflict or it's clear that we're going to have a major custodial issue in the litigation, I've always been a fan of trying to come to an agreement with the other side to engage a neutral custody evaluator. But that's, as we said earlier in this episode, a lot of times it's a court-ordered thing and the parties are compelled to do it. Doesn't mean they don't drag their feet, right?
Right. No, it's true. And, you know, one of the things I often will have attorneys request a conference call with me beforehand, just, you know, they want to see logistically, am I able to do it? You know, what's the time frame to get it done? Things like that, you know, or to introduce me to an attorney maybe I haven't worked with yet, that kind of a thing. And one of the things that always is like code word for me of going, oh, no, is an attorney will say to me, this is really simple, Dr. Hansen. And I'm like, I have never, ever, ever met one of these evaluations that is simple. And now you just informed me that this is going to be one of my most difficult cases. Because unfortunately, with experience, I've learned the second they say simple, it is a difficult case.
Never believe the attorneys.
The attorneys out there who work with me, don't use the word simple in my world. You scared me now.
As far as I'm concerned, if you have to be appointed, it's already not simple.
Right. And that's how I look at it. I'm 99% sure it's a high conflict.
Yeah, exactly.
If I've come involved.
Exactly.
Yes.
So, and talking about high conflict, we've had a number of shows where we've talked about high conflict types of cases. A lot of times there's, you know, addiction issues involved or narcissism, things like that. We've had shows involved, you know, many shows with that. Amy Baker talked about parental alienation. What kinds of indicators do you look for to see, you know, if there's a narcissistic personality disorder or something like that?
Oh, personality disorders. Yes. They are quite synonymous with high conflict. And, you know, I've had the opportunities of hearing Bill Eddy and Amy Baker and all of them speak on it, and obviously see it in my own clinical work. Some of the indicators that we're dealing with probably a personality disorder are symptomatic that comes through the DSM-5. And again, you know, as a custody evaluator, I'm not diagnosing a parent, but I am a clinician. And so those symptoms come out. And I think the biggest things are, you know, what are their relationships like with other people outside of this divorcing marriage? You know, do they have friendships that they've kept a long time? Do they get along with their family? If they don't, why not? What is going on? Is it about them? Is it the family members and they've set healthy boundaries with them? What is that about? Are they able to keep a job? You know, or are they somebody that jump from job to job, or they've gotten fired because they get in conflicts with coworkers constantly? Or they've been inappropriate with clients, things like that. So those are some of the things I'm looking for. You know, is there some weird, bizarre beliefs that, you know, and I don't get into religious beliefs. I'm, you know, anybody can have their religion and I respect that. I don't really care what your religion is. But, you know, are these beliefs really atypical? And if they are atypical, is it because there's a different culture? Or have they grown up in the same U.S. culture all their lives, and so this would be really different based on their culture? So those are some things I'm looking for. How do they interact with their children? How do they interact with their co-parent when the marriage was intact and doing well? Is there domestic violence? That's a really big thing, and the Association of Family and Conciliation Courts has put out a whole set of standards just on domestic violence and evaluating for domestic violence in custody evaluation. So that's a very serious thing. And there's a lot of personality disorders that are associated with domestic violence.
Yeah. You know, and the high conflict cases are certainly a high preponderance of cases I've been involved in that needed a custody evaluation. We at least had a suspected, at least one parent had a suspected personality disorder. But the most heartbreaking cases are the ones that you just referenced with Dr. Baker, and Rebecca mentioned we did that episode with Dr. Baker called Co-Parenting with a Toxic Ex. And that's all around parental alienation. And I'm sure with your breadth of expertise, you've had those cases of parental alienation. And we still get a lot of feedback from listeners on this topic. So when you're doing an evaluation, what are the indicators that you're looking for? What are some of the things you can tell our listeners that you're looking for to find parental alienation, or to see what you're, you know, what you see in that case? Because it gets bandied about, that term is now being bandied out about as much as narcissism is. You know, we hear it all the time.
Oh, it is. It is. It is. Or people using the term I'm OCD because they're, you know, organized. Yes. And I agree. And it's, you know, definitely when somebody comes in saying, you know, I'm being alienated from my kids, I definitely raise one eyebrow and go, are you really? Because it is an overused term, you know, just the same as, unfortunately, I'm a victim of domestic violence, is that makes me go, let's see, I'm going to evaluate it. I'm not saying you're not, but unfortunately, that's something I hear quite often. And quite often, alienation and domestic violence, those allegations come hand in hand. I'm keeping my kids from him because he battered us. So that's a common thing. So I'm looking at, I love to look at William Austin's restrictive gatekeeping, and he lists out, you know, areas such as, you know, keeping phone contact and, you know, tending to get overly involved in the other parent's parenting time. You know, I'll ask for phone records. How many times has dad texted during mom's parenting time? That's something I love to see, because that's a sign for me. I love to see, you know, are we scheduling appointments? Are we scheduling activities on that other parent's time purposely? Things like that. Are we communicating? Did the child have an activity at school and dad never found out? Because the form came home to mom, mom signed it quick and made sure that dad didn't know. Things like that. Did a parent take the other parent off the school records? You know, so now all of a sudden dad was always getting emails and mom went to the school and said, oh, dad's not supposed to have this anymore, and took all of his information away from the school. Things like that. Did mom go in and she has an injunction for herself and she told the school, oh, there's an injunction against dad, so he can't have access. So those are things that I'm looking for. And, you know, I would say it happens in both cases. The other thing I would say is, most common what I see in these alienation cases is that there was one parent who historically, and not in every case, let me make that clear, but historically has been overly involved in the parenting and done 99% of the parenting work. And the other parent has been the breadwinner. So they're, you know, working 60, 80 hours a week. And so it creates a perfect storm when we divorce, that the person who's been the primary parent is like, well, these are my children, so they're coming with me. And, you know, trying to change their identity. Their identity has been being a parent, where the other person's identity has been their job. And so that can be really hard to say, well, you can divorce and now you're losing your job, so find a new job. And so, and what you've done for the last 10 to 15 years to care for these kids, or even if it's 2 years, doesn't matter, find a new job. And, oh, you get to split your time with your kids. So that can be really, really hard. And so those are some things I'm looking. I also go off Drozd research. You know, Leslie Drozd has done an incredible job researching this topic, as has Kunal and some of the others who've worked with her, Walker, all of those. I look at their research studies. I love their tables in trying to evaluate things. I'm looking at, you know, the domestic violence studies that have come out. I'm following the AFCC standards in evaluating for that. And it really says in every case, whether the allegation is there or not, we're supposed to evaluate if domestic violence occurred in any case. And so I'm looking at all of those things. So are they legitimately gatekeeping and protectively gatekeeping these children because, you know, mom threatened to kill them and mom attempted suicide in front of them? Or are they keeping these children away because they're scared to death that the children will create a healthy relationship with that co-parent and may actually like that co-parent better than them? And what is that about?
Yeah, I think sometimes it's about winning too. You know, I'm going to get my kids to like me better, and then that will hurt you. You know, and
or I'm scared of paying child support, or I'm scared of not getting enough child support to be able to survive.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that there's a number of different things that motivate people to alienate their children, but they forget about the fact that the children are actually both parents. They, you know, they're part of both parents. They and so if you get them to hate the other parent, then they're basically hating a part of themselves. I mean, it is a form of child abuse.
Abuse.
Yeah.
It is. It is absolutely abuse. And there's a lot of good research coming out showing it as abuse. Unfortunately, you know, Department of Children and Families and things like that isn't recognizing it as abuse yet, at least not where I practice.
And the judges aren't either, and that's the problem too.
It's mentally and emotionally abusive. Some of the judges are here. Some of them are aware and see it as that, and have even said that to parents on the witness stand, which has been very empowering, I think. But unfortunately, it is mental abuse, and I see it no different than name-calling, shaming, you know, when you have a parent that fat-shames a child. I don't see it as any different. It's traumatic and traumatizing, and it creates psychological discord in that child. It's very hurtful.
And very long lasting in a lot of cases. So,
a lifetime.
Right. Yeah.
Coming up, more from Rebecca and Susan on part two of The Kids Are All Right, or Are They? An Anatomy of a Child Custody Evaluation with Dr. Christina Hansen.
Men can be victims of domestic violence, and that's huge. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they are beat up and have bruises all over them. It can be mental abuse. It can be financial abuse. It can be things like that. And it's not, and I don't automatically assume if a woman comes in and she's 5'2", all of 110 pounds, and he's 6'1", over 200 pounds, that he's the aggressor, because I have seen very petite women who physically abuse their husbands that are very large men.
And now a word about our sponsor, Courtney Davies of Symmetry Financial Group. So as divorce attorneys, Rebecca and I know, divorce can wreak havoc on your finances regardless of your means and your wealth. Debt is a national crisis, and the banks are not here to help you. They're really one of the major culprits. Now there is a revolutionary new approach that will let you eliminate all of your debt in 9 years or less, including your mortgage, without spending any additional money.
Interested in learning more? We thought so. Certified debt-free life advisor Courtney Davies is offering you a free consultation on how this program works and can build out a customized plan just for you. Head over to CourtneyDavies.com, check out debt-free life, scroll down and submit the form. That's CourtneyDavies.com. It's time to take control of your financial well-being, folks. Begin your journey to financial freedom today and tell them that you heard about them on Breaking Free, a Modern Divorce podcast.
Take a listen to our archive, where you can hear Rebecca and Susan discuss more topics on divorce in depth, including part one of The Kids Are All Right, or Are They? An Anatomy of a Child Custody Evaluation with Dr. Christina Hansen.
One of the most interesting evaluations I got asked to was to make recommendations as to whether children could visit grandparents who resided in a nudist colony.
Oh, that's great.
That was quick.
Yeah. Just out of curiosity, what were your thoughts on that?
And now we return to today's show.
So, you know, another place where we see evaluations being ordered are in move away or relocation cases, because, you know, those are almost impossible cases. They come down to one of the parents wanting to move with the children somewhere usually remote from the other parent. It's the most gut-wrenching in many cases. You referenced earlier, I'm going to lose my kids. Well, this is like physically your children are going to be somewhere else. So very often we do get custody evaluations ordered, but what types of, you know, interviews or testing, research, et cetera, do you do for that type of case?
I think it's important to look at one of the biggest keys is the financial resources in the family. You know, if this job that, you know, mom's wanting to relocate for with the children offers her more financial resources, you know, how much more that's better for these children, and will there be the flexibility for the children to still be able to see that other parent regularly? And, you know, if they're traveling, you know, say most of them are a long distance commute, and what is it going to look like to fly to reach that parent? Well, we practice in Southwest Florida. Our airport's pretty small and there aren't many direct flights. So how many flights is the child going to have to take to get back to their parent? Things like that. Are we going to be going, you know, two or three changes of flights, or, you know, is there a direct flight, or there's one layover, but it's not Atlanta, which is enormous for a child to try to transfer through? So those are some things that I look for is, you know, and the parent that's wanting to relocate with the kid, have they been really good at making sure the child has a healthy relationship with that parent? Have they been really supportive of that parent's relationship, you know, flexible with that parent, things like that? Or have they just been a stick in the mud on everything? And then how flexible are they going to be relocating when Susie has a sporting game or Susie has dad's weekend? You know, that's important to me. I want to see that you would put the child's relationship with that other parent as a priority over all else. You know, are you going to make sure that Susie goes to Mother's Day with mom, or are you going to say, nah, you know, Susie sees my wife as more of a mom, so we're going to spend Mother's Day with my mom or with my wife, things like that. Those are some things that I'm looking at. And then on the flip side, the parent who would be staying behind, what has been that parent's involvement? Has that parent been a very involved parent? Or has that parent essentially been missing in action all this time, and this parent's been doing it on their own anyway? That's important to me. You know, has this person, one of the things in the Florida statute is, have they been paying their child support or not? You know, or is this a person who's been in and out of jail and not seen the child much? That, you know, that to me is telling, like, let's go let this other parent have the freedom they need to better their life and this child's life than this person who, you know, every 6 months is getting in trouble for domestic violence or drugs or criminal life. That would tell me, you know, is this parent who's not relocating, it's because, you know, they're in jail for the next 3 years. That would be pretty significant. So those are some things I'm looking at, or they just haven't been involved. They live three blocks away from the parent, but they don't show up for their parenting time. They aren't involved in the school. They couldn't even tell me what school this child goes to. Well, then obviously it is in this child's best interest to be able to go with their parent who is their caregiver. So things like that.
Yeah. So, I'm looking at the time and I'm thinking, my goodness, we have still so much that I want to cover with you. So I'm like looking at the list of things that we wanted to cover, thinking, where should I go here?
But, there's a lot involved.
Yeah, this has been, I mean, so I know people are going to love this. So let me just get this question in, which is, because domestic violence is a big issue and you've talked about that, you've touched on it. And, you know, as you mentioned, a lot of times people use whatever they think they need to use in order to get leverage in a family law case. And so, unfortunately, for the people who really are experiencing bad things, most of us in the family law world, judges included, are a little bit jaded when it comes to this, because we hear about it all the time. And many times for me as a family law practitioner, a case will come to me after somebody's been arrested for domestic violence, and then that is what precipitates the divorce. So if you could just elaborate on that just a little bit. What is the percentage of real cases that you've seen where bad stuff is actually happening? I mean, or just sort of approximate. And then how do you get to the bottom of it and figure out what's actually going on?
Yeah, I don't know my exact stats. I would say as far as the ones that truly have violence versus the allegations, unfortunately, the true violence is far less than the allegations. Right. So that would be what I would say. However,
and by the way, I'm lumping sexual assault allegations in this as well, right. Like any of this kind of thing.
Right. So, you know, I will say that what I'm looking for is a pattern, history. And even with that said, you know, not necessarily calling the police, because majority of victims don't call the police because they're scared to death of the ramifications if they do. They're scared to death of the retaliation. And it's also oh so common that maybe they do and they get an injunction and then they're charmed and they let it go. We see that over and over again. You know, how many times have you said to your clients, do not let this injunction go? But, you know, he didn't mean it. He's apologizing. He loves me. He promised this. He promised that. And they let it go. The other thing I will say is men can be victims of domestic violence. And I think we like to pretend that doesn't happen. Men can be victims of domestic violence. And that's huge. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they are beat up and have bruises all over them. It can be mental abuse. It can be financial abuse. It can be things like that. And it's not, and I don't automatically assume if a woman comes in and she's 5'2", all of 110 pounds, and he's 6'1", over 200 pounds, that he's the aggressor, because I have seen very petite women who physically abuse their husbands that are very large men. So, you know, I always say that it really knows no race, no gender, no socioeconomic status, no profession. I have seen medical doctors. I have seen attorneys who are victims of domestic violence. I've seen judges who are victims of domestic violence. So it really knows it can happen to anybody. And so I think it's very important to keep your mind open and not just judge a book by its cover. I'm looking for the evidence. I'm looking for, you know, how many times has he called his mom and said, "Help me, I don't know how to handle her. How do I get along with her? How do I keep peace when I woke up in the middle of the night to her pounding on me?" You know, things like that. So I'm looking for the historical, the essentially the collateral information that helps me understand it. Did they date in high school and they broke up because he beat her up and then they got back together later? Does he have a history with other relationships or does she have a history of other relationships? That's where all of that collateral information can be helpful.
So I'm thinking, you know, now we've talked a lot about how you pull the information together, the investigation, the discussions, the testing, the interviews. Now you're pulling together a report, you know, and Rebecca and I have seen these reports. We've dealt with them in court. These are not little, you know, 2-page reports that we can flip through quickly and highlight a couple of sentences. These are novels, you know, that come in.
It's a tome.
It's
100 books.
Yeah. It's like when that hits my desk, it's a good solid thump when it gets put there.
Yes.
So maybe you can describe for our listeners so they understand the true breadth of what you're creating here. What goes into your actual written report?
Oh my gosh. You know, it takes me a long time to write these reports. And like I said, I've done hundreds of them. And so, you know, I'd be able to become quote unquote more efficient, but I honestly never have billed for the total time it's taking me to write a report because it's not just me sitting at my computer typing my little heart away. It's also the time that I've thought about processing it and thinking about it. The nights that I haven't slept because I'm thinking about that case, right? We all have that. So, you know, it's, and I don't charge for that. I'm not going to charge for when I'm awake at 2 a.m. processing your case. So it is a lot. And I think the key is, you know, I try my best to succinct and document everything I've looked at so the attorneys know the documents that I've seen versus what I haven't, because there's oftentimes parents who haven't given me everything and the attorney will say to me on the witness stand, "Have you seen this?" And I'm like, "Nope, didn't get that one." Or, "Yes, it's somewhere buried in here. Let me find it." So, you know, that's something that's huge. I also try to make sure that it's clear how much time I've spent interviewing each side, the time that I've spent interviewing, the collaterals, who I talk to is very important. I always make sure the dates of when I talk to people is there, any testing I've done, the results of the testing, things like that, a summary of the case, you know, kind of a history timeline summary, information on each parent, information on each child, the issues that each parent has presented and the findings regarding each issue, the statute, if it's applicable, you know, Florida has a statute, so that's in every one of my reports. Some states don't. And then, you know, what are the summary of it? And then recommendations, which is probably the biggest thing in there that attorneys are looking for is...
We flip to that page first.
Yeah. You've given us all this junk that you want us to know how you got to where you are. But at the end of the day, what do I have to convince my client we have to do? Or what do I need to hire an expert to refute?
Yeah, that, one or the other. That's it. That's why we flip to the end.
And so... Yes. And so, you know, I try to be as black and white and, you know, as detailed as I can. At the end of the day, as you guys know, we can create the best of parenting plans, but we don't have a crystal ball to predict the future of this family. And so I try to be as thorough as I can. And I would say with every report, it's a learning lesson for the next report. Every time I testify, it's a learning lesson for the next evaluation. Attorneys and clients are sometimes my greatest teachers in regards to what to put in next. I remember an attorney saying to me, "You know, Dr. Hansen, you do a great job of defining under each category every parent's strength and weakness, but it would really help us at the end if you had a table that went through the statute and put, you know, which factor this parent favors which parent." And so I learned for the next time and added that. So sometimes that's some of my best teachers.
Yeah. So just to kind of reiterate what you just said there, I just want the listeners to understand that once your report is rendered, the judge can take all of it, some of it, or none of it. The judge has the ability to throw the entire report in the trash can if he or she wants to. They normally do not. I will say once they have appointed the court appointed neutral, they listen to what you have to say. And so now the side that doesn't like what you said has, you know, they can either try to immediately get into mediation and try to get the other side to agree to something that's other than in your report, which is a slim chance of that, because if they like it, then they're going to go, no, I'll take my chances. So, or they have to hire somebody like you, but it wouldn't be you, obviously, if you've done the report, but let's say it was somebody else, then they can hire somebody like you to come in and go, well, this is where we think that the other evaluator, you know, missed the mark in some way. And so now, by the way, the couple is paying for a second person, and both experts need to be deposed, and both experts need to come to trial, and they need to both be paid for that time. So, you know, it can get very, very costly. Anyway, this has been so helpful. So, I think we could have actually had you on for like 2 hours.
Everybody would have been bored.
I think this topic, I mean, if our listeners are getting nothing else, I think they have a better understanding now of just how complicated this issue can be. I know for clients at the time we start talking about, you know, getting an evaluation, they really do think it's going to be, I'm going to go tell my story to the evaluator. They're going to see everything the way I see it. I'm going to get this nice written report that recommends my proposals, and we're going to be done with this. And I think, you know, after listening to us just talk for an hour here in these two episodes, I hope our listeners can see just how complicated this is, and such necessary work. But you really are not taking a glancing blow at these people's lives. You're making important recommendations, and so you're doing really a deep dive into a lot of their personal information and lives to get these answers.
It is. And it's a very vulnerable position for them, because here is a stranger who is, you know, microscoping my life and critiquing me. And out is going to come a report, like Rebecca said, most often the judge is going to agree with, and I'm going to have to do. It's a very scary process for people. And I often say to myself, you know, what would I do if I were in their shoes? And it would be really hard, really hard.
Yeah.
For anybody, because there's no perfect parent out there, and I'm not a perfect parent. I've yet to meet a perfect parent, so it's tough.
Yeah.
So Dr. Hansen, where can our listeners find out more about you?
My website is probably the biggest place to go. That would probably be my number one thing. And then I also write several articles that you'll find listed on my website, and then the Grit and Grace Project, which is one of my favorite places to write. And then I've written for other people as well. So that would probably be the biggest place, my website. I don't have social media.
What is your website?
www.drhansencohen.com. So www.drhansencohen.com.
Well, I'll be sure to put that in the show notes. And we really appreciate your sharing all of your expertise with us in these episodes. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you, ladies.
Yes, thank you. And I'm going to put it, we'll make sure that we put in the Grit and Grace Project, because I love your blog. It's awesome.
Definitely.
It's a fun venue to write for, and they're really a great organization. So I love it. It's therapeutic for me to get that information out there and help people who maybe don't have the means to talk to a psychologist. So it's fun.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today on Breaking Free, a Modern Divorce podcast. I'm Rebecca Zung.
And I'm Susan Guthrie. Check back next Monday for our next edition of our powerful, inspirational, and educational podcast. And if you enjoyed today's podcast, please remember to give us a 5-star rating and let us know what you liked in a review on iTunes.
And remember, you're just one step away from your new life.